It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Mom is the first person many of us turn to when we're sick. Mothers have that certain magic touch and seem to know just what we need in order to feel better. Moms have taken on the role of house doctor for centuries. They had to learn medical practices from their own mothers and from other women because they were not allowed into traditional medical schools. But there were alternative medical practices that invited women to participate. Mainstream doctors named these practices quackery. Erica Janik, the author of Marketplace of the Marvelous, The Strange Origins of Modern Medicine, explains to Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson exactly what quackery is and why women were drawn to it.
It's funny, when I first went into this, I really thought that quackery had a very clear definition, but the thing that I really discovered going into this project and learning more about the 19th century is that basically quackery comes down to anything you don't like. So there can be a variety of reasons that you don't like something, and so a lot of the things that we think of as quackery in the 19th century were actually mainstream doctors' kind of opinion about some of their competitors in the medical field.
So then how did you go about researching this quackery?
So I went about doing it just kind of reading about what was actually going on, what people were doing for their medical treatment. I discovered a world that was really diverse in terms of how people were seeking care for their various ailments. It was really a process of really discovering that there really weren't a lot of trained medical doctors in the U.S. This is a very big country, and so the doctor could often be pretty far away. They were mostly concentrated in urban areas, and so people were relying on all kinds of different methods in order to heal themselves. And so I started looking at letters and newspaper articles, also reading home medical guides. We think about those diet and health books that we see all over the place, grocery stores, bookstores, even at the airport. Those books have been very, very popular for centuries, and people in the 19th century were buying them too. So I started reading a lot of those and just seeing what kinds of things were people proposing about what was causing disease and what were the various ideas of how to cure it.
So this really started to pop up in the 19th century, or did it carry over from the 18th century and from Europe when people were immigrating from Europe to America?
People have been using alternative therapy really for centuries. The very earliest colonists to North America, we're using all different kinds of remedies as well, home remedies, what we think of as patent medicines that they purchased. And so it really was a carryover of centuries-long tradition, and immigrants were bringing some of those traditions from Europe with them as well. But what happens in the 19th century that makes it kind of notable is that these kind of movements start forming. So there were these kind of disparate types of healers all over the place offering all different types of remedies. But in the 19th century, you find them kind of banding together, kind of forming around a particular theory of disease and how to cure it. And so they become kind of larger movements that sweep over the country.
Speaking of banding together, I'm also finding a lot of parallels between women's rights and irregular practices like hydropathy. And why did alternate medicine appeal to women? Is it based off of the kind of the rural health care? If they had to wait for a long time for a doctor to come, did the moms and wives have to kind of take over? Or how are women connected to the different medical practices?
Kind of a combination of those things. So for centuries, women had really been acting as their family's primary caretaker. They were really acting as kind of the nurse and the pharmacist and the doctor, really doing anything they can to help keep their families well, as well as helping neighbors give birth to babies, lots of midwives. But in the 19th century, you find these alternative groups kind of forming, and they're very welcoming to women. And one of the reasons that they are is that women have a hard time getting the medical attention and care that they need. Most of the mainstream doctors are men, and kind of social propriety means that a lot of women are too embarrassed to actually go see a doctor. And even when they did go see the doctor, he often wouldn't examine them because he was so worried about offending their sensibilities. So a lot of women were really suffering, and suffering unnecessarily, according to these alternative healers. And so as these groups are forming, they really see an opportunity in women. They think that by welcoming them in, both as patients and practitioners, that this is a way to really grow the audience for their theory, but also a way to solve kind of a major health problem in that women aren't getting the attention that they need.
I've also saw a lot of celebrities throughout the book, ranging from people like Mark Twain to President Andrew Jackson. Did these people have a role in these medical practices like endorsements, or what role did these people play?
A combination of those roles. It depends on the person, of course, but you do find that basically all of the bold-faced names you can think of from the 19th century, these people were trying an alternative remedy. That didn't mean that they weren't going to see a mainstream doctor, too. You know, that's something that's kind of been very common throughout our history, that people go see one kind of doctor, but they're also trying a bunch of things on the side. And so you find all different kinds of famous people in the 19th century are, you know, suffering from sickness and want to be well, so they're trying all of these different things. And some people did become very outspoken advocates for a particular type of healing. One of those was Harriet Beecher Stowe. She wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, but she also loved the water cure. And she wrote about it, as well as her sister, Catherine Beecher, also loved the water cure. They were very big proponents of it. You also find a lot of writers who were using some of these therapies were then writing about them in their novels. They weren't necessarily writing these novels as, you know, advocacy pieces for a particular type of healing, but you'll find that a character actually uses homeopathy, or a character goes and gets their head phrenologized.
And that was, I found that fascinating, too. It's just that the different celebrities wanted to get their heads examined to see how accurate it was.
That's right. You know, I mean, I think we all kind of want to know about our characters and our personality. You know, we have all of these kind of existential questions about who we are and what our potential is. And so it's really appealing to find a therapy like phrenology that seems to promise to unlock all of those secrets that are in your head. And so people would go over and over again trying to better understand themselves, how to make themselves better people. Mark Twain goes over and over to get his head phrenologized. He tends to make fun of it when he does write about phrenology, but he keeps going back and he keeps trying it. So, you know, that's an interesting, like, dichotomy there of him. You know, he thinks it's kind of ridiculous, yet he can't seem to stop going and seeing what they say about him.
And then speaking of the mind and brain formation with mesmerism, it seems to have come with a lot of drama, including King Louis XVI, who ordered a committee to be formed to investigate Franz Anton Mesmer's practices. What was it about this medical practice that created such a problem?
So one of the things that people were very, very concerned about is that a lot of the mesmerists, their theory was basically that there was this invisible fluid, animal magnetism, that was kind of flowing throughout the universe in and out of our bodies. And they would kind of direct this invisible fluid into you and kind of move it around your body, and this would help cure your disease. Now, most of the practitioners of this form of therapy were male, and a lot of their patients were female. And they would cause this, what they called a crisis, when they were actually performing the therapy, and people would kind of become unconscious or go into convulsions and fits. And people were really nervous about what these male mesmerizers, what kind of like mind control they were having over their female patients and what they could be causing them to do. And again, that social propriety idea, were these men taking advantage of these women? They really had no idea. And so the King of France, his wife, really loved mesmerism. And he was like, what is going on in there? And so he does form this committee because he thinks that mesmerism sounds absolutely ridiculous. So he puts together all of these very great French scientists and an American, Benjamin Franklin, to investigate this theory and try to figure out, is it actually real? Is something actually happening? Because it's so very popular in Europe.
How did the mesmerism tie into Christian Science?
So there's all kinds of mental healing. They kind of start with mesmerism, and then it takes on a variety of different forms throughout. You know, mesmerism starts in the late 18th century, and then in the 19th century, it kind of morphs into different things. And there was a man named Phineas Parkhurst Quimby who believed that all disease was basically just a figment of your imagination, that you were having kind of wrong thoughts, and that if you replaced those wrong thoughts with good thoughts, then happiness and health would result. And he became very, very popular as this mental healer. And there's a lot of modern ties to what he's saying, basically telling you to think positive, be optimistic. And one of his patients was Mary Baker Eddy, who went on to found Christian Science. And she used a lot of the ideas that she learned from Quimby as part of her new healing faith. So you do find this really long continuum from 18th century Vienna all the way to late 19th century Boston, where Christian Science really takes off.
How is it different from hypnosis today? Or is there a difference?
Well, there is a little bit of a difference in that hypnosis is not necessarily designed just for healing. I mean, hypnosis is definitely part of what these mesmerists and these mind cure healers, this is what they were kind of tapping into, the unconscious part of your mind. But they believed that the secret to healing disease was in that unconscious part of your mind. Whereas hypnosis is more just a general idea of tapping into that unconscious, but not necessarily for healing ends. And there were some other aspects to it about, you know, thinking positive and replacing those bad thoughts with good thoughts. So there is a little bit of kind of a psychology about it.
Milwaukee didn't seem to really escape this either, because Milwaukee had its own Reinhardt brothers who sold medicine to, quote, cure private and secret diseases particular to men. So how did they get to the men, and were they successful?
So I love the Reinhardt brothers. I mean, they're horrible. It's really, so these are very clearly the quacks that we think of, the people that are just kind of bilking people out of their money and preying on innocent people. So it was twin brothers and then an older brother. And they ran a business in Milwaukee called the Wisconsin Medical Institute. And men generally would come to see them. And no matter what complaint you came to them with, they would diagnose you with a sexual dysfunction. So if you said you were having heart palpitations, they would say, well, that's because of your sexual dysfunction. If you said, you know, you're having excruciating headaches, well, that's also a sexual dysfunction. People could also write letters to them. You didn't have to travel to the Milwaukee office. And they had kind of a character that they called the master specialist, who would diagnose your problem through the mail. And of course, it was a sexual dysfunction. And he would apply all different kinds of remedies and try to figure out how much you could actually afford. That was a big part of it. They kind of did a little background check on you. And then they usually gave you some kind of electrical device, usually an electric belt or an electric vest to heal you.
And this was just for men, or did they also apply things for women as well?
It was primarily geared at men. They did have some advice in there. They wrote a medical handbook, also very common for people to do in the 19th century and early 20th century. And they did include some advice for women. But the vast majority of their practice was really aimed at men. But they offered kind of life advice, too. They gave some tips in the book about how to meet and marry the perfect woman for you, and then how to have a perfect marriage. And it was kind of it's an interesting book because it's a little bit sexually explicit, something you wouldn't necessarily expect. And they offered various devices that they said would, of course, make your life more pleasurable.
Of course.
It actually took several years for the state of Wisconsin tried to shut them down for many years. And when they finally succeeded, the Journal of the American Medical Association actually came out with an article congratulating the state for finally shutting these guys down.
So they ran them out of town, and where did they go? Does anybody know?
Unfortunately, they actually just went to another state and set up another business. This was kind of a continual thing. They were actually from Minnesota originally, and they had run a fake business in the Twin Cities. They got run out of Minnesota, so they came to Wisconsin, set up another business. So what we think happened is they just moved on to another state and unfortunately started bilking some other people out of their money.
How have these developed over time since the 19th century? How did they become more credible?
So what you find is that a lot of these people kind of on the fringes, these quacks in the 19th century, were proposing some new ideas about what disease was and how to cure it. Things like drinking water, things like exercising, eating fruits and vegetables. These were kind of out there crazy ideas in the 19th century. And as the century wears on, though, you find mainstream medicine kind of starts to adopt some of these ideas. And as medical science is progressing and we're learning actually more about disease, because before the late 19th century, we didn't know about germs. We didn't know that insects could transmit disease or that human contact could cause disease to spread. But as we're kind of making these discoveries, some of these ideas that had seemed really out there all of a sudden started to make a little bit more sense. Now, a lot of the people that were proposing them in the 19th century took them to rather extreme ends. So hydropathists, the water cure doctors, they recommended that you drink water, but they also recommended that you basically soak in cold water, take showers in cold water. It was like an 18-hour day of water treatments, which is kind of an extreme end. But the idea of keeping clean and drinking water is a good idea. And that became part of public health campaigns by the late 19th century and early 20th century. And you find this happening with a lot of the ideas that these alternative healers were proposing.
Well, this is just absolutely fascinating. So, Erica Janik, thank you so much for talking to us about your book, Marketplace of the Marvelous, The Strange Origins of Modern Medicine.
Thank you.
Erica Janik is the author of Marketplace of the Marvelous, The Strange Origins of Modern Medicine. She'll be at a book signing at Boswell Books on Downer Avenue tomorrow night at 7 p.m. She spoke with Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson. There's more information about the book on our website, wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, we'll talk about Sherman Park. It's one Milwaukee neighborhood that's trying to get the diversity equation right. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio.